thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
Tonight's word comes from Joshua 22. Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and said to them, "You have done all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded. For a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission the Lord your God gave you. Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest as he promised, return to your homes in the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But be very careful to keep the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to obey his commands, to hold fast to him and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul." Then Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their homes.
Oh, well, good evening. Welcome. It's good to have you here tonight. We're continuing, as you've been told, through the book of Joshua, and we're going to be taking then a couple weeks break, obviously, for Mark Coleman's ordination. He's not here tonight. He and Nicolai are in Fiji with his parents, who are out from England. They're out here in part because of the ordination next week, so I would encourage you to get up early-ish and come to church next Sunday morning and support him, and then be here in the evening as well. We'll hear a little bit of Mark's story as well, and then we have Easter after that, so we'll be kind of pausing this story and then coming back to the last couple of chapters in a couple of weeks' time. Well, for those of you who enjoy literature or you enjoy movies or television shows, whatever it might be, you always know that when the climactic event has taken place, the bad guy's been defeated, the monster's been overcome, the love of one's life has been revealed, whatever it might be, once that climactic action has happened, there's usually not much left. Right. Once the main action is over, all they generally do is tie up a few loose ends and maybe set the stage for a sequel. And largely that's what we're dealing with here in Joshua chapter 22, 23, and 24, the first chapter of which we're going to be looking at this evening. It's kind of tying up a few loose ends and setting the stage for the sequel, which is the book of Judges and what follows in that text and beyond. And yet, as we saw last week, the theme of these last couple of chapters is rather wrapped around the invitation for faithfulness. So last time we had a look at the lengthy telling of how the land was distributed to the various tribes. And the emphasis in all of that, in the way in which the land was distributed, was to emphasize the faithfulness of God to his promises and the invitation for his people to then live faithfully in the midst of them. And so we find in chapters 22 and 23 and 24 that this theme of faithful living continues. And it's introduced here in chapter 22 as the narrator also ties up a bit of a loose end. If you have your Bible with you, you might see that it refers to either the eastern tribes or in some translations, the Transjordan tribes. And you might remember in chapter 1, at the very beginning of the story, when the Lord had said to Joshua, "Okay, get ready and go into the land," the first thing that Joshua does is he goes to these eastern tribes, the tribes who had territory on the eastern side of the Jordan. This goes back to the book of Numbers, when the people of Israel were attacked by the Amorite kings, Sihon and Og. The Lord handed the Amorites over to Israel, who defeated them soundly and took all their territory. And then a couple of tribes kind of had a look at the land, and they said, "You know, this land is actually pretty good. What about if we stay here?" And Moses said, "You can stay here, these 2.5 tribes, you can stay here on one condition. And that condition is that when the people of Israel cross over into Canaan, you go with them and help them conquer the land." So Joshua in chapter 1 says to these Transjordan tribes, the tribes on the east, "Remember what you said. You said you would come and help." And they say, "Yeah, we'll come and help." And in chapter 4, when they cross the Jordan, it's the tribe of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh that go ahead of the people of Israel armed for battle. And then they kind of disappear in the rest of the story until we get to the inheritance, when we're reminded that they don't receive a slab of land anywhere on the western side of the Jordan because they've order to receive their land on the east. And this is the story that gets picked up here. And Joshua calls all of Israel together to Shiloh, the place where the tabernacle of the Lord was, the place where God's presence was, the Ark of the Covenant. And he brings them all together and he says to these 2.5 tribes, "You guys have done a great job, thank you." And it's fairly extraordinary. He says, "You've done all that Moses had commanded, you've done all that I've commanded, and you've actually stayed around for a long time. You haven't deserted us. You've been faithful to your promises to do what you said. Now we are at rest. You can go home." And he sends them home with three things. He sends them home with a blessing, he sends them home with all of their plunder, and he sends them home with a warning. And the warning is quite a strong one, isn't it? He says to them once again, "Be very careful to keep the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, to keep his commands, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." This is the warning. And so off these tribes go. But as they're going home, they stop at a place called Geliloth, just on the border of the promised land, and we're told that they build an imposing altar. I don't know about you, that sounds like a pretty good biblical thing to do. You know, kind of build an altar, I don't know, thankfulness or something. And so we're a little bit surprised, I think, when we hear what the rest of Israel reckons. So again, if you have your Bibles, have a quick little look in verse 11. "When the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Geliloth near the Jordan on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them." Do you get the feeling we've missed something, perhaps? They built an altar, which sounds like a kind of a religiously good thing to do, you would think, and Israel is about to go to war. Well, what seems to be going on here is actually something that was talked about in the book of Deuteronomy. If you have a look in Deuteronomy chapter 12, we have some fairly specific regulations about how the people of Israel were to worship. Now, the book of Deuteronomy is set just before Joshua. So it's not just that it's the book before it. It's set just weeks, maybe months before the book of Joshua begins. This is the last things that Moses says to the people of Israel. And a lot of it is shaped around what it's going to look like in the land. So in Deuteronomy chapter 12, he says this. Starting in verse 2, he says, "Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, burn their Asherah poles in the fire, cut down the idols of their gods, and wipe out their names from those places. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way. But you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go to worship." So the whole idea is if you leave all of these high places, all of these little shrines, all of these places where the Canaanites worshiped, if you leave them there, you're going to be led into worshiping other gods. So to avoid that, knock them all down, destroy them all, and just worship in the one place. Just worship here in Shiloh. Stay in Shiloh. There is the right place to worship. So the people of Israel who have heard about this new altar think that the 2.5 tribes have already forsaken the Lord. And so they send a delegation. It's led by a priest whose name is Phinehas. Phinehas came to prominence in the people of Israel in Numbers chapter 25, where he is central to stopping a plague that had come upon the people of Israel for idolatry and apostasy. He had actually killed two perpetrators of this kind of grand apostasy and was said by the Lord to have a great zeal for the name of the Lord. So Phinehas is the one who leads this delegation to find out whether or not there's been unfaithfulness. And they cross the Jordan River and they come to the Transjordan tribes and they make some fairly serious accusations against them. In chapter 22, verse 16, they say this, "How could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? Was not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day, we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of the Lord. And are you now turning away from the Lord?" To which the Transjordan tribes respond by saying, "No, that you've got it all wrong." And the rest of the dialogue outlines this. They say, "Listen, that's not why we did it at all. We didn't do this to offer sacrifices on. No, instead, have a look at what they say in verse 24. We did this for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, what do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord. So your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. And so we built this altar as a sign, as a reminder that we're in on this. It's a replica of the one in Shiloh. So if your descendants ever say, hey, you Lot on the other side of the Jordan, you're not part of us. We can say to you, have you seen the big kind of imposing altar, the replica? Why do you think it looks exactly like yours? This is the story. Well, Phinehas and the tribal leaders go, that sounds legit. So they go back home and they say, it's all good on the eastern side. Everyone's happy. Everyone praises God. We're told the name of the memorial. And that's the end of the chapter. And we're left with the same question we have after so many passages in the Old Testament, aren't we? What do we do with that? Where's the point of application here precisely? I mean, has anyone been building replica altars lately? This is no longer the regulation that we hold to. We don't have to worship in one place. We worship wherever the Spirit is. We worship wherever two or three are gathered together. What is this all about? And I wonder, I want you to recall that this passage is not just tying up a loose end. It's also wanting to teach us some very important things about faithfulness. And so I'd like to just take a few minutes and suggest a couple of places where we might be able to reflect on faithfulness to the Lord out of this text. So let me begin by just making this fairly important observation, that the context in which we find ourselves defines the nature of how we seek to be faithful. In other words, the things that we're going through shape the challenges of faith for us. So sometimes we go through really hard times, don't we? And in hard times, faithfulness to God has its own challenges, doesn't it? Everything is much more immediate. The stakes are much higher. Everything is black and white. The contrast is very, very sharp for us. We need God to come through. If he doesn't come through, we're in all sorts of trouble. And the struggle to remain faithful is very clear sometimes when we're going through difficult times. Sometimes the struggle is very, very difficult when we don't feel the presence of God. And all of a sudden, the presence of God that we're so used to just disappears and we don't feel him anymore. And so the struggle to be faithful changes. For the people of Israel here, however, there's been an important shift in the book. At the beginning of the book, they were at war. And if God did not show up, they were going to lose. In chapter 22, they have entered into a time of peace. And so the challenge of faithfulness changes. I think it's important for us to recognize that how we are faithful to the Lord will change as our circumstances change. The challenges of what it looks like to be a faithful follower of Jesus changes as our circumstances change. That's really important. But let me also draw your attention to something quite significant in this interaction between Joshua and these tribes. Because I think one of the things we see here is that your past faithfulness is no guarantee of future faithfulness. I mean, Joshua gives the 2.5 tribes who are from the eastern side of the Jordan a pretty significant rap, doesn't he? You have obeyed everything that Moses commanded you. You've obeyed everything I've commanded you. And this is not about military stuff. He's not saying, listen, when I asked you to kind of go around the city and kind of ambush it, you did it. Well done. He's not talking about that. He's talking about the things that were commanded by Moses. And those things are almost exclusively about faithful living. You have obeyed fully what Moses commanded you and what I have commanded you. Those are the same kinds of things. You've persevered in all of this sort of stuff. And if you know the history of the people of Israel, I mean, honestly, they get brought out of Egypt. They're rescued by the mighty hand of God. And within, it seems, just days, they are whining and complaining about the fact that God brought them into the wilderness. They're complaining that he saved them from slavery. They're complaining about his provision of manna. This is a group of people who were prone to wander away, and this group didn't. You fully obeyed Moses. You fully obeyed me. You've been faithful to the Lord. But their past faithfulness is no guarantee of future faithfulness. We cannot live on the past. The whole point of maturity in faith is not to kind of escalate to some great height of spirituality and then just drift home, hoping to die just above the ground. We're called to continue to grow, to become mature in all things and in all ways. I don't know how many of you have ever had this experience when you've been in a job for a while and you look back at what you were and what you knew when you were hired, and you have this thought: what were they thinking hiring me? I had no idea what I was doing. I had almost no experience, and then I made all those mistakes, right? We look back on that now and we think, wow, I thought I knew what I was doing, and I had no idea, and nobody caught me. I mean, right? To some degree, we should look back at our earliest attempts at faithfulness and say the same thing. We should be able to say with Paul, you know, I used to think and act and reason like a child because I was one. But now I've become mature, and those things, they're a little embarrassing now. What I thought was faithful then is not now. I have become more faithful. This is what we are called to. Ever greater levels of faithfulness, which means, when we come back to the text, that we have to be very careful about the bias or trajectory of our decisions. Because every decision that we make has a certain bias to it, a certain weight to it, that either takes us closer to faithfulness to God or farther away. You very rarely are we faced with a decision to either abandon the Lord or stick with Him. We're very rarely faced with one of those kind of, you know, complete opposite direction decisions. Usually we have dozens and dozens and dozens of these little decisions, tiny decisions, that either are biased towards faithfulness or biased against. They're not neutral. I mean, have a look at the decision that was made by these 2.5 tribes. I mean, yeah, we've heard the story. They didn't build the altar to worship on. They didn't intend to worship on it. They didn't intend to allow it to become a snare to them. But it's not a neutral decision, is it? The other tribes come and they say, to some degree, an altar? Couldn't you have built a fountain? Something that you couldn't possibly mistake for an altar. A big pile of rocks with a sign that says, not an altar. Planted a tree, for crying out loud. Done something. Anything. But it had to be an altar. Because what do you use altars for? Well, you use them to worship on. And eventually, that kind of decision, and you see this in the ongoing story of Israel, this decision ends up leading them into unfaithfulness. It's a decision that was just slightly biased towards unfaithfulness. So what sort of decisions are you making? What sort of decisions are you making right now about being faithful? Are your decisions biased towards greater faithfulness, or are they biased towards less faithfulness? Because our decisions are not neutral. They're not. And the trajectory of those decisions will determine long-term where we end up. So be careful of the bias of your decisions. And then I think there's one more piece that I'd like to reflect on out of this at least. And that is how the people of Israel confronted what they felt was faithlessness in their midst. They didn't gossip about it, did they? They didn't pray about it. They marched across the Jordan and said, "You've forsaken the Lord. You've rebelled against Him, at least from our perspective. Pull your head in, or we're going to march across and wipe you out." That's a little bit confrontational, wouldn't you say? Are you all feeling uncomfortable now? Thinking, what's He going to say? He's going to say we should turn to our neighbor and point out the sins in their lives, right? This is hard, isn't it? And there's any number of reasons why we don't confront stuff like this. I mean, some of it's kind of obvious. I mean, who likes confrontation? I'm not a big fan of confrontation and conflict. part of it's exactly what we see here as well, isn't it? I mean, the tribes on the west didn't have all the information. They didn't see the motivation. They didn't know that this was only a memorial, and so they had jumped to conclusions. And that's kind of the caricature of Christians, isn't it? We're often caricatured and stereotyped as jumping to judgmental conclusions, right? I don't want to be that person. And on top of that, like, I know the hypocrisy that's involved, right? I mean, who am I to tell you to get your life in order when I know that my life is not entirely in order? And that whole thing that Jesus talks about, you know, how can I get the speck of the ear when I got a big plank out of my own eye? And I know that, you know that. So we don't like conflict, and we don't want to come across as judgmental, and we don't tend to know each other well enough to know all the bits and pieces of someone's life, right? And we don't want to be hypocrites, and so we end up not saying anything about anything, and that is not a neutral decision. It's a decision that is biased towards unfaithfulness because it means we never talk about what faithfulness looks like. So what do we do with that? This sounds uncomfortable, doesn't it? Well, I don't believe that this is a prescription for us. I don't believe that this is how we're supposed to go about dealing with potential unfaithfulness. Grab your swords and your spears and march over and confront people really kind of in your face. I don't think that that's quite it. But I was thinking a bit about the importance of faithfulness and thinking, well, if it's so important for us to be faithful as the people of God, then how do we get this on the table again? How do we actually find a way to talk about what is faithful in our lives? And, well, I thought a bit about soccer. A coach, season started yesterday after all the rains, fantastic. And I was thinking about coaching on the sidelines. And there are times when I have to correct the behavior of the players, right? So in yesterday's game, there were a couple of times where I'd say to one of the girls, you know, you're on the wrong side of the field. I need you on this side of the field. I've asked you to play on this side, so stop running to that side. It was corrective. It was kind of, you've been, in the words of this, unfaithful, right, to the position I've asked you to play. I didn't use those words because that's weird, right? It's a soccer game. You need to come back to this side. But it occurred to me that, you know, while there are some times when I might be corrective in how I coach, most of the time I'm trying to find things that they do well and encourage them. I'm saying to them, that was a great pass. That was the right decision. Good hustle. Way, you know, way to get back. Way to provide support. All those kinds of things that you want to see that they're doing well. And I wonder if that can't provide for us a bit of a model. To get faithfulness back on the table, perhaps instead of looking for where each other have stepped out of line, perhaps we can begin by looking to see where people have been faithful and encouraging them. What if we sought really hard? What if we worked really hard to find one or two things that we could encourage? One or two acts of faithfulness, one or two decisions that were biased towards faithfulness, and say, I love that decision. I love the fact that you've prioritized your week to be at Life Group. That's a decision biased towards faithfulness. So pleased to hear that, you know, just you were talking about reading the Bible and you only read it once this week, but that's a decision that was biased towards faithfulness. Good on you. I'm so encouraged to hear that you're praying for someone in your workplace who's not a believer yet. I'm just so encouraged. That's a decision that's biased towards faithfulness. So encouraged to see you, you know, welcoming those people who joined our church. I was so encouraged to see you, to hear you, to overhear, to listen, to see, to watch. Good on you. And might that not provide us with an opportunity then eventually to perhaps also point out areas of unfaithfulness, but to do so in a context of encouragement, to do so in the context where we're looking for good things, where we're cheering one another on, where we're trying to find the things where we've been faithful and saying, that's what we're on about. That's what we want to see. We want to be a community whose every decision is biased towards faithfulness so we don't have to live on the past. That we can continue to mature and to grow and to become ever more faithful to the things that God has called us to. And perhaps it begins for us by finding things that we can celebrate and encourage in one another. This passage and the passages that conclude the book of Joshua are not just wrapping up some loose ends and setting the stage for the sequel. These passages are also trying to extend the theme that the narrator has been interested in from the very, very beginning, which is the faithfulness of the people of God. The faithfulness of the people of God as they live in the land, as they live out all that God has called them to, all that He has rescued them for, all that He has gifted them to be able to be. And so while our contexts might change, sometimes things are easy, sometimes they're difficult, at the end of the day, we are called to be those who weigh carefully the decisions that we make. To remember that we cannot just live on past faithfulness. It's no guarantee of our future. And that together we might begin to encourage one another to be a little bit more faithful today than we were yesterday. To continue to grow together as the people of God. So I want to take some time to pray for us, that we might be able to better do this as God's people.